listening to Vulcan Hello, the Incomparable's only podcast dedicated to new Star Trek. I am Scott McNulty, and I am joined by the erudite and handsome Mr. Jason Snell.
Hi, Scott.
Sorry, just trying to go against type there. Hello. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. May your travels be easy. That's and right. Your road safe.
Hey, we are here to talk about Janal.
Oh, the symbiote lives in Trill?
Yeah, and the episode named after him.
I don't know what the pronouns
symbiote
are.
Symbiote is...
Season 5, episode 3.
Episode 3, yes.
Janal. For people keeping track. Mm-hmm. Which is, this is roughly a third of the season that we have seen already, Jason.
I guess. Right?
It's only 10 episodes.
Yeah, so it's 30%. Yeah, you're 30%, right.
30%, that's true. Craziness. Well,
just a little less. A little less.
And Discovery continued. I was talking to Marisa about this. Marisa, my lovely wife, of course. About how Discovery is kind of, you know, each Star Trek, I feel like, has its own, like, one word or two word, or let's just say pithy description. That kind of summarizes the vibe, as the kids say. This is our new segment, Jason, Star Trek Vibe Check.
Okay, love it.
And I feel like Discovery's vibe is definitely, let's talk about our feelings. Mm-hmm. And this episode has a lot of feels in it. All the feels, as we were messaging before the podcast.
Yeah, I would say this episode... Okay, first off, I have a theory about season 5, which is season 5, it feels like the writers of Star Trek Discovery are extremely aware of their own... tendencies. I think they're extremely aware of what the show is, and
I think so.
You know, whether it's of everybody who talks about and writes about what they do on their show, or maybe whatever it is, they have internalized. Like, instead of it being like, let's try this and let's do this and this is the show we ended up with, now it's sort of like, no, this is what Star Trek Discovery
does.
And it feels like with these three episodes, they keep leaning into and then sometimes even hanging a lantern on things that are very Star Trek Discovery. And one of the things is very much the feelings. In fact, there is that theme in this episode that is, there's a voiceover at one point and it's all about...
at the very end, yeah.
Yes, a voiceover strangely specific to the episode theme. Strangely tangential for what it's supposed to actually be a speech about, but no matter, about connection and making connection. And I thought, see, that is Star Trek Discovery saying, this is what our show is about. And, you know, you can like it or not, or think there's too much of it or whatever, but like it is very self-aware in, I would say, a good way of Discovery knowing what it is as a show. And there was a lot of that in this episode, a lot of very Discovery things.
Yes. And I say that not to as a criticism, because I actually like it. And I've said before that I like how, you know, a show has to find its own identity. And I think they've figured it out. And what you could have done, I suppose, since there is grumbling on the internet, you could listen to the grumblers and say, well, let's kind of try and reboot or reconfigure and become, you know, Strange New Worlds and maybe they have a little bit of that, but they are still staying true to themselves. They turned into they leaned into the curve, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I like it. I mean, I don't know if this episode is not my favorite episode of Star Trek Discovery. But that being said, it is a very Star Trek Discovery episode of Star Trek Discovery.
There's also literally a moment where they have a conversation about how they really ought to be getting on to the next part of the quest, but they're not allowed because of some negotiation. And I thought, is that a wink at the fact that they so often are having serious conversations when we think that they maybe should spring into action? Because it felt to me like it was sort of doing that.
Maybe a little. And at one point, Adira is talking to Gray. It's, you know, another one of these connections. There are a lot of kind of, I was trying to count how many plots we have, and there are a lot of them.
Four-ish.
They say, oh, after this, we might have some time to just hang around, so maybe I can see your quarters and meet some of your friends. Yeah. And I thought, isn't this like the most important mission that you have? Isn't time of the essence?
So I'm gonna make a... I'm going to try to explain that away because I was thinking about this. One of the problems, and this does not address the issue where it seems like things are going to explode in 2 seconds and yet we're going to have a talk about our feelings. It's more like TV is all about time compression, right? So the way I read this is, look, there's a lot going on, but they're going to be on Trill for a while, and that they're going to do this ceremony, and then, you know, and the person's going to go off, and they're going to go do their thing, and everybody else is going to wait around. And I thought that line, I actually kind of read it as, this is a nod to the fact that time compression is happening. We don't see, it's not 24, right? We don't see every second, and that hours do pass. And what is every character who's not on screen doing in all those hours? And I think the answer is... stuff we don't see and nobody ever talks about. So that was the line. I kind of nodded at it and I was like, that's fine, right? Like, because that's the truth is that, you know, when they do, you know, they have an adventure, I don't think the adventure takes place in 50 minutes, right? I think it takes place over hours or days, and they don't show most of it. And a character who's off screen, like, they're doing something. So that dialogue, but I did also have that thought of like, but do they know? Like, I think they do. I think they know what they're doing when they do all these things this year for sure.
Yes. And you have now convinced me that, because I was thinking they were talking about once they find the clue, but you could read that as they were just talking about, because Adira doesn't really do anything
right,
other than is just there to meet Gray and kind of hang out in the background.
Gray, when you're off work, can we hang out?
Yeah, we have stuff to talk about. And oh boy, do they. Although it's not a very dramatic talk, but we'll get to that. So there's the threads. Let's talk about the different threads in this episode.
Well, before we do that, Scott, I think we've given a hint, but we should say, how do we feel about this episode?
Oh, I always forget the feelings episode. Yeah. I will go first.
We also share our feelings.
We do. It's
connect.
You know, we take our hints from our episodes here. I will connect with my feelings and share them right now and say that I thought this was a middling episode of Discovery. I didn't think it was awful. And I liked some of the stuff in here. I was kind of deeply annoyed by a certain aspect of it, which we will get to.
Okay.
It's mostly those personal transporters. They always make you think about transporting and dire situations.
I think I know exactly what you're going to say, and we'll get there. I'm with you. I don't think this was a very good episode. I don't think it was a bad episode, but I don't think it was very good. And I think the problem is this, and I know I've given this kind of criticism about Discovery before, but I'm not saying this is what the case is, but it feels like they outlined the season and thought that episode 3 would have some very exciting things in it about this next part of the quest on Trill. And when it came time to write it, they didn't really have enough. And so they sort of tried to stuff a bunch of other things in it. And I think there's always something going on, but it's like four plots or subplots. And
it doesn't feel like there's a main plot.
Are that interesting? Some of them are more interesting than others, obviously, but they're none of them is super gripping. And I would also say that with some minor exceptions to a minor subplot, I also found it all completely and utterly predictable. And predictable doesn't have to be bad. Sometimes it's comforting to have it be like, you know, there are things in this episode that are very much like, oh, this is such a Star Trek episode, and those are good things. But at the same time, I felt like 10 minutes in, I knew every single beat that was going to happen in this episode, and I was 100% right.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about this before, and certainly on my other Star Trek podcast, Random Trek, I talk about how the really good episodes of Star Trek are great, obviously. The bad episodes of Star Trek are fun to talk about because they're bad. And then the ones in the middle are kind of just disappointing because they're not good enough to be interesting, but they're not bad enough to be interesting either. And this is kind of where it, for me at least, where this episode falls.
Yeah, I agree.
It has its moments.
It does.
And I like the concept, and I think you're right, Jason. They were like, oh, we're going to go to Trill. This will be so exciting. And they were like, well, how can we pull the scene where there's these cloaked animals and they're fighting against that? How can we pad that a bit? Because there's not much. It basically boils down to they visit a planet, they talk to an old woman, and they pick up a thing.
which they already, like, they took a hike and picked up a thing last time. And they're taking a hike and picking up a thing again. But this time there are like they're going into the lion's den, sorry, into the Edgernox den or whatever.
Oh, the Edgernox, yes.
But that they're just, you know, it's there's not a lot of incident to it. And there was a moment, okay, all right, so this is the main plot, right? Is mm-hmm. is they're going to put the mind of a past 800 years ago Trill host in some
Culber,
crew
right?
member. It turns out to be Culber. Because that's the host that has the knowledge. Now, first off, I'll just say it's not how trills work, I think, or at least how I've been led to believe trills work, where the symbiote has the knowledge. But in this case, the old lady with the symbiote is like, no, we don't have the knowledge. It's just in the host. Which,
oh well,
I mean, there's an episode
of Deep Space Nine where this happens too.
Yeah, there's a lot of hand waviness that is okay because it's sort of like, well, look. It's clear later as the scientist talks to them about it that, like, this is a whole plan to make it so it's hard to get to the MacGuffin mm-hmm. and that you have to earn it. And so keeping it out of the symbiote, but having the symbiote be like the gatekeeper of the knowledge and then having to do this ceremony in order to get it, I'm okay with that. Like, I'll accept that. So Culber gets the knowledge and turns into this guy who hasn't been alive for 800 years. And he makes some comments about the uniforms and unzips his thing. And then his jacket. That's what he unzips. And, and says, great. Now we have to take a hike out. They're like, can we beam to where you left the thing? And he's like, no, we are going to walk and I'm going to enjoy it. Cause I've been dead for 800 years and I'm really enjoying being alive for a few hours. And so we get him and Book and Burnham taking a hike, having a chat, and then they disturb the Edgernox and mm-hmm. who turn out to be guarding their nest.
Aww.
And so there's some fight shenanigans with mm-hmm. Burnham and Book. The Trill in Culber basically says, well, I'm out of here. I don't want to kill this body that I'm using, so I'm going to take off. And I had that moment where I was just like, it's all just a test. He's just testing them to see if they're worthy. That's what this is. And mm-hmm. you know what? That's absolutely what it was. But they did do the very Star Trek-y thing of, after fighting with the monster for a little while, realizing that they need to understand the monster. And it's actually just a couple of parents who are guarding their nest. Aww. And Book does the thing, the glowy thing on his head to say, we're okay. We're going to get out of here. And then they get out of there. And then, of course, Culber Trill reappears and goes, haha, you passed the test. I'm like, yeah, dude,
the clue is really over here.
But Scott, my favorite thing in this whole episode is in the fight scene with Book and Burnham, because mm-hmm. you mentioned personal transporters. I like the fact that he's popping around. He's like teleporting on the battlefield to lead the thing around. Mm-hmm. And then there's that moment when he sees them firing a thing at Burnham where he leaps in the air.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Transports to the other side and then is continuing his leap down in order to protect Burnham. And that little bit of like transporter action business, I thought that was pretty cool.
I agree with you. I noted that and said that is pretty cool.
There are other uses in this episode of personal transporters that are not cool, but that one, very cool.
And I will say, this brings me to, so I have 2 points that I agree with. This episode reminds me of a much better Deep Space Nine episode called Facets. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem with having a huge catalog of, your Star Trek Discovery is not only living up to itself, but it's also trying to live up with my memories of all the other Star Treks as well. So, which is unfair, but it's reality. And my other problem, Jason, is when I have two problems, but they address one. So they're meeting these angry, stealthy bug things. And I think to myself, can't Book commune with animals? And so he does, and they reject his communion. And so they're angry and that's fine. And then I thought they are trapped here with some angry, angry beetles. Why don't they A, either beam themselves away, or B, beam the beetle away and hold it in like a transporter buffer and then quickly get the thing and then put it back, and none the wiser would anyone be. But they don't do that. They just run around.
Well, and the Beatles are cloaked, and they probably can't. And they actually did. I mean, I admired their effort where they're like, okay, let's just beam out of here. And they're like, oh, no, we're too close to some rocks.
Well, we're under some rocks, even though Book was just beaming everywhere. Yeah. Maybe now we just walk by, like a foot away. Now they're by away.
The rocks, and they can't beam from by the rocks.
And I understand. The transporter makes it difficult, and so you have to deal with that. But that was just annoying. But they do. Yes, it was very nice that Michael Burnham realizes, does the Star Trek-y thing of saying, they're just, you know, we have to put away our weapons and just say we are here to do no harm and we're sorry. And so that's fine. And they get the thing and everybody's happy and it resolves itself fairly quickly.
Well, so what happens is that, right, is that there's no thing to get. And so they give up and they're just going to get out of there. And then that's when Culper Trill is like, aha. That's you passed my test. Here's the thing.
Yeah, she didn't kill the bugs. Okay. So,
other things I liked in this episode, I enjoyed Culber turning into the Trill. I thought that was kind of funny that he like. I mean, in the end, it's sort of like it's all a setup and it's all a test. But I enjoy the whole kind of like I have no particular place to go. And plenty of time to do it, and I'm enjoying being alive. And they're like, "Come on, man, we got a thing we're doing here." And he's like, "Whatever." I actually really enjoyed that whole bit with Culper as the possessed as a Trill, and I liked the aftermath where he again hanging a lantern on Star Trek things. He's like, "Another consciousness was in my body, and except I was there too, and kind of watching, but not there. How does that even work?" It's like, good question. No answers, but good question. I love it. But, that part was good too.
Marisa, at that point, though, turned to me and said, you would think Dr. Culber, who has come back from the dead, would be more open to these strange experiences than he seems to be in this particular moment.
And may not even be anything but a mushroom who thinks he's a man.
That's true. Is he man or is he mushroom? I don't know. No. And he doesn't know either. I don't think he may. But I did like, if we take away the fact that he has come back from the dead from via mushrooms, I did like the fact that he was like, whoa, what is that all about? And then it did lead me. So Michael Burnham says, oh, but maybe we'll find all the answers once we find the progenitor's technology, to which I thought, that should make you think you shouldn't look for these things because that seems like it's not good. And I think they're setting up these little seeds of doubt in should they or should they not have this stuff,
which
is also Star Trek-y.
Did you notice, in fact, they had that moment where they're like, oh, it could create life or even whole planets. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you're describing Genesis.
Oh, the Genesis, yes.
It's not
I
good.
Did.
You could also destroy everything with it. Mm-hmm. They didn't.
Yeah, so I think I'm excited about that, kind of the hint of that. And I think we'll hear more of that as the season goes on. So that's good.
Sure.
And so that's the main plot. It's pretty straightforward. There are also a million other plots. So why don't we talk? We talked about Adira and Gray. So they are a kind of minor plot in that they're, you know, long distance relationships, even with hollowed Zoom, they're difficult. And Adira is nervous to see Gray after 6 months, and they feel like things have changed, and they don't know. So
it's all awkward. And my favorite thing in this whole plot is that they talk to Reno, and Reno's like, "Oh yeah, you're screwed." And then Stamets is like, "Well, what are you talking about?" And it's like, "Bless your heart."
She calls him Space Dad, which I enjoyed.
Like, I just, a good use of Tignataro there. That was a good scene.
And Culber, and Stamets is like, is it going to be bad? No, it'll be fine. Everything's fine. It'll be fine. It turns out it's bad.
Yeah.
Adira and Gray reconnect, and they both, you know, and this is very relatable to anyone who has had multiple relationships that, you know, you grow apart and you get to that point where you still like the other person, but you're like, we don't like the us doesn't work.
Right.
Separately, we do work, and that's basically what they come down to.
Yeah.
Although Gray seems more excited than Adira does, frankly, but sometimes that happens.
Yeah. I've never really been a fan of Gray. I didn't think that character ever really worked out. Clearly, the producers weren't either. They wrote the character off. Mm-hmm. But it seems very familiar. Anybody, and they have feelings, and they express their feelings, and they decide that they will be friends and stay in touch. But, you know, it's not.
Which is nice, but
they're not
going
to be together in that way. And that's all fine. I found this whole subplot not only predictable, but just like just super boring and by the numbers, and almost like they felt like it was obligatory to show Gray again and obligatory to go because they were going to go to Trill, especially that they had to do it, but that nobody's heart was in it. I don't know. It's just my least favorite of the subplots, I think.
Yeah, I feel like they could have made it. I mean, this episode, some might argue, is a little overstuffed, but I think it could have been more interesting if Adira was nervous and then went to see Gray and saw that Gray was just so happy being a guardian and made it like. And then Adira says, "Okay, well, maybe I should step away because this is clearly Gray's, you know, future, and I should sacrifice this relationship and release him so that he can pursue his guardianship without having to worry about me." But they don't really do that. They're just kind of like, we've grown distant. Maybe we should be friends. Yeah,
long distance relationships are hard. I get it.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, that was one.
So from one relationship to another, we've got Captain Saru, Ambassador to Small Planets.
Yes.
Which I don't know if that's his official title, but it should be. And his love interest, or his fiance, actually.
President Tarina of Var.
So Saru's got a new office. Mm-hmm. He's got a new plan. Yeah, he's got
plants and misters and all those. They're gonna. Mm-hmm. By the time he's done with his job, they're gonna have to set up another. They're gonna have to leave it as a museum or botany center or whatever, just like on the Discovery. Yep.
He just leaves a
trail
a
of moss of, wherever he goes. Yes.
Exactly. I was like, it's Saru in here. We need to stop giving
musty.
Him these big offices.
Saru, right. Oh. That's why Kelpians are not that common. Is that they're just. They leave mulch everywhere they go.
They are a very moist,
peaty
lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But I did. I like these two kids together.
Yep.
And any scene that they're in, I was like, let's spend more time with them. Because I know they're just talking about their engagement, but
so
I like it.
I liked this subplot. And it was also the only thing in the episode that didn't quite go the way I thought. And it's because, they all agree, and she's got her aide, who we've never seen before, and he's a Vulcan, and he's back there, and he's like, boop-a-doop-boop, okay, yeah, bright boss, whatever. And then after they do and he's like, and Saru says, "I'm going to have a controversial vote." And she's like, "Well, it doesn't matter, we're in love, and it doesn't matter." And then he does a thing, and she votes for it, and her aide comes up to Saru afterward and is like, "This is going to look real bad back home."
Yeah, this matters.
So among the things that I like about this is the implication that politics exist. She's not just sort of everybody agreed she's the best, so they made her the president. Like, there's politics on Navarre, especially since you've got, remember back when there were, what was it, logic extremists?
Yes, now they're Vulcan purists.
They're Vulcan purists now. Boy, those guys, they're just the worst. Anyway.
I imagine there's a lot of overlap in those two groups.
Yeah, probably so. And then I'm sure they're Romulan extremists too. And
they're,
I'm sure that
they're better at hiding, though.
That's the whole point of Navarre. Mm-hmm. Navarre is interesting in a way that maybe Vulcan isn't, because it's now the home planet for these different groups who are trying to get along. But some people, I like the non-uniformity of it. It's like not every planet is just desert or just ice. It's like our planet. It has lots of biomes. Well, they also
ice extremists.
A complete planet is going to have politics and different points of view, and even though they may be unified in terms of being part of the Federation, there is internal politics. That's something that happens. So I like the impression of that going on, that she has political calculations she has to make as the president. Of course she does, and yet Star Trek tends not to deal with this stuff very often. I like the fact that, here's another thing, her aide, who ends up basically saying to Saru, "I think this is bad for her political career. She won't listen to me. Maybe she'll listen to you." And he says, "Oh, okay. I'll take care of this," without asking questions, which is his fault, which he apologizes for, which I also thought was good and maybe a little surprising that it's very straightforward.
It's very mature.
Saru is a solid, mature individual who's like, "No, I messed that up. I thought I was protecting you." And she says in a great line, she's like, I do not need your protection, right? Like, this
right.
is
it's just like,
I'm
what
the
gave
president
you the impression
of a planet
that I need? Yes, I'm okay.
I am accomplished in my own right. You don't need to protect me. But what I like about that aide is that he's not a villain. He's actually motivated by worrying about his boss's political future, and And so that's not wrong. He's just decided to go around her to the new guy and see if he can tap that. And then obviously that frustrates her probably with Saru and the aide, although the aide seems, the aide is not wrong. It's just that mm-hmm. Tarina has made her choice and it's gonna, she's gonna take the hit, but she's gonna do it because she'd rather do this than try to hide it and then have it, because the cover up is always worse than the crime, Scott. It's always worse than the
it's
crime.
It's true. So no love is crime, Jason. No
so,
love
so, crime. Well, yeah, but still, well, on Vulcan, it might be.
Oh, well, that's true.
Navarre. So I like this because I think every character behaves understandably and Saru does make a mistake, but then apologize for it. And I love to also get, we get the Vulcan apology and Vulcan apology acceptance in this episode too, where she's like, I accept it's in the past, done. And it's like, okay, well, that's a very Vulcan way to deal with an apology is to be like, yes. Check, filed, done. We'll never speak of it again. It's like, okay, all right.
The past is the past.
And Saru's like, what?
What is going on?
I thought we were going to be like angry and it was going to be very upsetting. And she's like, no, that doesn't make sense. You're sorry and we're over it. It's like, okay, she's great is what I'm saying, Tarina. Love these crazy
They're both
kids.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think I totally agree with you that this is the best part of the episode, even though it is kind of extraneous to what is happening in the episode.
Totally. It's about the feelings and connection, though, Scott. Mm-hmm. See, that's
well, and it's a misdirection, too, because they very cleverly show her little Vulcan assistant, like, kind of lurking in the background.
Yeah.
But he's not really...
He's going to be a villain. Just, he's not.
Because you're like, oh, this guy, he's up to no good. We know when Vulcans lurk, they're up to
naughtiness.
He's a
secret Romulan, and he's going to try mm-hmm. to make everybody hate Saru, and he's going to turn them against each other, and none of that happens.
They take a little walk where they use their personal transporters because I guess they don't have stairs anymore
here,
to go upstairs.
Scott. Personal transporters are great. Mm-hmm. Do you need to use them to go upstairs?
You don't need to. You are privileged enough to take advantage
of them. Do they not have elevators anymore in the 31st century because everybody can just transport to the next level up or something?
Well, if Discovery has shown us anything, turbo lifts take up an incredible amount of space.
They do. Boy, think of the space that they're saving by mm-hmm. not having those turbo shafts. But so. I'm just saying, it's when they beamed upstairs, I thought, that's a lot. Like, that's a lot to just go up, to beam upstairs. It seems a little bit much, but okay.
But I did like they were clearly trying to show, like, he's taking Saru to... you know, away from everyone else to have a little clandestine meeting where, you know, but I totally get where you're coming from. It's a bit ridiculous that they needed to transport, like,
the truth is they built that set in the shopping mall or whatever it is. It's the multi-levels.
And they're gonna use it.
and they don't have rooms off of it. So they just say, well, we'll just go up one. Okay, great. Great.
Transporters solve all the problems, Jason.
I just leaned forward and was like, what happened there? Why why did that happen?
Yes, I love that guy, and I love the fact that Saru is like, oh, I have to protect her, and she's like, no.
Yeah,
and that he is and he says something about, you know, he was trying to avoid conflict, and he's not used to, you know, dealing with conflict in these kinds of close relationships. And she basically says conflict is part of any healthy relationship. This is completely normal. We're basically saying, you know, we're going to have more of this. It'll be fine. Let's send out our engagement announcement minus the one line you didn't like. Which I also thought was funny because it begins with, you know, he has a problem with being called erudite and handsome. And she says, well, it's true, but if you don't want it, we'll take it out. Which is very sweet.
Right.
So that subplot had it all. It's very sweet. It's a mature relationship.
Also,
it had theoretically evil Vulcans who just want to help their boss.
We make fun of Vulcan things a lot when they're like trying to logic people to death. And it is a really great moment when Saru says, cause he tries to give this super logical argument about why Saru needs to delay the engagement announcement. Mm-hmm. And Saru is very polite in saying, among other things, your argument is a touch circuitous. I thought that was really great. Because
his argument was, it is only logical that I reach out to you because President Tarina's logic is clouded by emotion, but you're always clouded by emotion, so you should be able to tell the logical thing.
And a very Vulcan thing to say. And mm-hmm. Saru's response is basically like, yeah, you know that makes no sense, right? I enjoyed that.
Like, oh, darn it. Just do it. It'll hurt her career. He's like, okay, fine. I'll help. So that was a highlight of the episode, that plot. And every time we left it, I was less excited. Yep. Although I did like, once again, we like our righteous jerks, who's a little, he's super jerky, maybe a little less right in this episode. Yes. We've got Commander Rainer, who's been ordered to, because this is Discovery. And as I said to Marisa, when Captain Burnham basically says, go meet the crew, you got to make connections.
So,
and I thought, you can't be on Discovery without talking about your feelings.
So I have a theory, which is, I feel like what the charter for this subplot was, is essentially Rainer is from a different Star Trek show. And
yes,
he's on a different Star Trek show, and on his Star Trek show, Star Trek Rainer or whatever, it's like many previous Star Trek shows, he is from, like, look, we don't talk about our feelings, but we all pull together and we work for the ship and we do it, like on you know, TNG or TOS or whatever. It's mostly not about our feelings. And Tilly, great choice to pair Callum Keith Rennie with Mary Wiseman here. Tilly is like, yeah, no, you know what show you're on right now?
You're
this
in the feelings
is Disco
show.
Baby. You gotta talk about feelings here. And he's like, no, this is not what we do. It would be just like if Picard was on the ship, or Riker or something. It'd be like, no, I'm not doing that. Just send them in, and I'll do whatever. And so I enjoyed their interactions. I enjoyed especially the scene where she finally gives it to him and gets to the last.
I
like the
words.
Yeah, where she's like, you know, you're a total. That's 20. Or try, you're being a giant. That's 20 words. Okay. I also really like the montage where everybody else is trying to say interesting things, like there was a binar and this thing was eating its eye, or saurians reproduce asexually, of course. And Nilsen went to the USS Voyager, but she gave me a pet tribble who was neutered. That's that tribble we saw earlier.
Yes, I love that.
And
closing the loop on the tribbles.
I think my favorite one, ones were the two last comedy ones, which was Reno saying, you know, the last time I did this, they gave me chips, and you know, for the job interview, and then the other crew member says, well, I'll save my drag racing story for the next time. It's also so, like, those bits were funny, and the stuff with Tilly was really good. My only issue with this whole thing is that, as you said, I love a jerk who's right, but here he's just a jerk who's wrong. And like, how could anybody have advanced to the rank of captain without having even the barest, like, I could accept that he's bad at it or he doesn't think it's necessary, but here he seems really clueless for a while. And then they try to redeem him by saying, oh, but I've had lots of thoughts that I've kept to myself that I've learned from all these people. And Tilly is trying to teach him how to interact with other beings. And I'm like, do you really need Tilly to tell a captain how to be a captain? Because that doesn't seem right. It doesn't. I mean, like, I get Tilly is good and she's been on the show, whereas Rainer has not been on the show and doesn't know how it works. But like, it just seemed like he was dumber than he needed to be, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, and I think that, so they try to explain it by Tilly saying, you know, you're being mean because you're demoted and you don't want people to think, like, and you're on a new ship and
it's
you want to cover up for that, and,
I mean,
which is a good scene.
Yeah.
And I think that she is right. And I think that it is not the actor who's playing Rainer's fault that the script doesn't really allow him to express that himself.
Yeah.
And so I think that would have been better if they had shown us that instead of Tilly just telling us that, because I think it is true.
I was hoping what we were going to get is him having a long game and Tilly giving him a speech and discovering that he actually has been working with these people afterward using the knowledge. And she's like, oh, he did get it. I misjudged him. But that doesn't happen, right? He, like, is sitting grumpily in the bar where there's the Red the Ferengi, I guess, is serving stuff at the
Slug-o
bar.
Slug-o Cola.
Yeah, but exactly. So what did we learn here? I mean, that's the thing. Is just, I was just kind of hoping that there would be a little bit of a twist there where maybe Tilly was misjudging him because she didn't like his style, but that he actually was getting to where he needed to go. But that, it sort of head fakes toward that. And then it's like, no, Tilly needs to give him more advice this veteran captain has to receive more advice from Sylvia Tilly. And like, yeah, okay. But which is why I keep coming back to the fact that this works much better if you just view it as he is from a different show and has to be read in on how Discovery works, which is everybody here, when something's about to explode, they just stop and talk about their feelings. And you have to do that too.
Well, and I think they went too far with it. Because I think what they should have done, and this is me once again, not a screenwriter, so take this with a grain of salt. Sure. But he is a captain on a ship. And I think you're right, Jason. Basically, every Starfleet ship is its own Star Trek show, right? Mm-hmm. And so he was the main character in his Star Trek show. And now he is on a different show where the rules are different.
Yeah, he got a show canceled. So now he's on a different show. And he's not the star.
He's like Worf on Deep Space Nine when he had to figure out, how do I deal with these? Everything's so dark. Why isn't it uniformly lit everywhere? He has to understand what's going on, but he doesn't. So he's trying to apply the rules from his show, like you said, and his ship to here. And I think it would have been fine if he gives everyone he had 5 minutes, right? So give everyone 5 minutes. But then they made it, okay, it's only 30 minutes, but 30 seconds, but he's going to insult you too. And it's like, it's too much. It could have been fine if he just gave them 5 minutes. He doesn't really want to meet them. He's doing it because the captain told him to, but he thinks it's kind of silly because he was the captain. And now he's this, you know, the first officer, and the first officer's kind of job is talking to the crew and making sure they're okay. But I think they went too far with, they were like, we really have to make him be a jerk to everybody.
And it makes me not believe that he's somebody who, like, I just don't see how this person could be this accomplished and behave quite this badly. In a way that again, in Star Trek Picard, Todd Stashwick's character is a jerk, but I understand why he behaves the way he does. And here, Rayner, I just don't buy that somebody who has this long a track record would behave this way, even if what Tilly says is true and he's just being a baby. It's hard for me to believe it.
I would have bought that more because he's clearly just trying. He thinks there are more important things to do. So I think you could have telegraphed that with, he's burying himself in this work and he's always kind of
puzzle.
Mission is first. I need to solve this puzzle and, you know, the crew will be fine. I don't need to meet this, like, a waste of my time and talents to just talk to these people. So he could have just had them come, which he does, to him, and I would have had him just basically ignore them instead of interrupting them and kicking them out.
Or use them to do research for him for his project instead of actually talking to them. Yeah, yes. Give them all assignments and have Tilly come in and be like, what are you doing?
Why is everyone doing things that they're not supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I just caught Linus up on the bridge and he's doing like an analysis of Mal and Lak's ship. What is that about? And he's like, well, I wanted to know. And Linus seemed bored, so.
He didn't have much to tell me in
30
seconds.
What was I going to do, ask him about his reproductive cycle? No.
I did, oddly enough.
Besides which, he's a Saurian. I already know about that. Anyway, this is all much better than what's in the episode. But it's fine. Again, I think viewed on a... If I step away from the fact that I think that it's just too much with him and it's just a little too extreme, I enjoy... Mm-hmm. The jokes. I enjoy his connection to Tilly. I just wish the resolution had shown him to be a little more capable than he was. And they show a glimmer, right? Like, he has been paying attention and is already thinking about, like, well, Reese, actually, there's a command path that works for him, given, like, how super into ships he is. And, you know, he is doing reads. In that one scene, he's showing his expertise. His behavior doesn't fit quite right to me. So anyway.
And I think the payoff to those scenes is good because it's that scene with them at the bar. And of course, there's a Ferengi and Sluggo Cola. Yep. So I enjoy that. But that's neither here nor there. And he basically says, you know, I have different methods, but I did glean important information about them. And to which Tilly basically responds, analyzing them is different than making a connection. And then so you're like, oh, okay, see, that's the good payoff. But I'm not quite sure that it earned that payoff. But
exactly. But it's there's fun stuff in there. And I enjoy Callum Keith Rennie. And it's great to see Tilly doing stuff. Mary Wiseman doing the Tilly thing again is good. I just I get what they were going for here, but yeah, it's just didn't land quite right for me.
No. And is there anything else in this episode? I can't even remember now.
There are a couple things that I didn't mention earlier that I want to throw out. One is the ceremony, the Trill
Yes.
connection ceremony. I really like that because that was a very Star Trek-y thing. It felt like, you know, like a Vulcan ritual kind of thing where they do a, you know, there's a planet and people put their hands in various places and it causes magic telepathy things to happen, and I thought that was all pretty good. And the special effect where Culber is kind of like getting flushed down the toilet as the new personality enters his mind and all that, I thought that was pretty good.
And it's a very clever thing from Deep Space Nine to have your main actors have to take new roles.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting to see someone you know act differently. So
this is very much a Deep Space Nine or TNG plot, the A plot being one of our characters needs to, have a thing done to them and then they become different and they have, like, that part of it felt very familiar. And that's not a bad thing necessarily. It felt like a very familiar Star Trek trope, but that's okay. I just, you know, in the end, I don't think they did with it what I would have liked them to do with it. I don't think it added a whole lot. And like you said, it bears the burden of many other episodes of Star Trek there. I'll also say the line where he says, wow, this guy really worked out, made me laugh a lot. I thought, again, very knowing. And in that scene where there's the thing you mentioned earlier where you were frustrated by, like, Gray says, we should have a talk, you know, capital talk, after the ceremony is over while they're off running around in the quarry. The right before that, there is the line of dialogue that made me laugh the most, which is, do you have a little time now? And I thought, that is something nobody on Star Trek Discovery has literally ever said, which is asking if somebody has time to have a conversation about their feelings. And that was one of those moments that I thought, they're doing this. Like, they know what they're doing here. They are very well aware of their tendencies and are playing with it. And I, having seen every episode of Discovery, I enjoyed the self-awareness about that whole thing. So, yeah.
And I will say, I think the symbiote caves look very cool. And they got candles everywhere. There are pools.
And at the end of the episode, there's like a symbiote swimming away.
Swims back into the pool. Is that the symbiote?
From the old lady, I think.
I'm assuming.
I think she dies. Assuming. They don't really go into it. But like she wants to rest and the symbiote wants. And I thought that was really cool, right? Seeing the Trill symbiote just kind of like a big tadpole just swimming into the pool in the cave. That was cool. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Oh, and we didn't even mention at the very end, while they're hanging out, Gray and Adira, it turns out that Maul is there and dressed as a monk or whatever, and sticks a tracker on Adira. Because I was wondering, how are they going to keep caught up? And this is the answer.
They went to that planet
that they were at last week. So they're like, okay, they set off. They're on our track. And then here is that moment where she does that, so we can understand why they will find them next week.
I did like that, but I did. They very knowingly show a lot of guardians or monks or whatever with their hoods up. And I thought, one of those hooded figures is going to be doing something they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Sure enough,
hung a hoodie on that. I guess so.
They sure did.
Well, that's all I got about this episode.
Yeah, I think that overall it was fine.
Yeah, just I mean, I felt after the kind of 1-2 punch last week, I thought it was a little bit slack and a little bit just not quite. It was sort of, they kept trying to stuff things into it and it didn't help. So it's just, you're right. It's more fun to talk about a really good or really bad episode. And this was just an episode. It references other episodes that are better than it. And it does some fun stuff. But I don't think it ever really comes together and shines. I think it's just sort of present. Oh, well.
Yes. And I think that so the many previous series of Star Trek have the advantage or the luxury, I should say, of having many more episodes per season. So right. you can be more forgiving with a kind of a middling episode in the middle of a 24 or 26 episode mm-hmm. season. But we only get 10 episodes of Discovery. And I want – you kind of need every episode to hit the right notes. And while it is in that way, tonally, it's totally Discovery. It feels – you know, it's not like I didn't – it wasn't an awful episode, so that's good. But it was you need to be better is what I'm saying. But hopefully episode 4, Face the Strange, I don't know. I didn't see a preview, so I don't know anything about it. We'll be a little better.
I hope so. This one, I think the A plot just was too insubstantial. I think that it would have been better if there had been more incident on their little hike than there was, mm-hmm. right? Like, I feel like they didn't like a classic like TNG or DS9 episode. There would have been like, I don't know, Culber would have gotten injured and they'd be worrying about like him dying and trying to stabilize him and having to come up with a plan. And, mm-hmm. and like, there would have been just sort of like a little bit more there. And there,
yeah. And then they would have had to like decide if they're going to save him or, like somehow they have to save the consciousness or Culber will die, but the consciousness won't. And then they would lose the clue or something and they'd have to make – and that would be the choice. And then he would be like, I see that you people over 800 years have gotten more
– just felt like there was – peaceful. Just a little bit more. I'll go with the idea that it's all a test. But mm-hmm. like it just – there was so little incident in it that they felt they needed three subplots to go along with it. And I hope it's not the case that there was more incident and they took it out because they wanted those three subplots in there. But that's not what it feels like. It feels like they felt it was just too light and so they crammed some other stuff in it. And I think that was a mistake and that they should have made the A-plot better.
Yes, and I'm okay with a rather baroque set of riddles and clues that they need to do because it's all set up by this Romulan scientist. So yes,
that was good.
I say more of that.
Good. Yeah, and again, hanging a lantern on it, but I enjoy that we talked to this character who was there with the other scientists 700 years ago, and like, well, we did this on purpose. We made this the way it is on purpose. It's meant to be a test. It's meant to
be. We're
not
just going to beam there.
Yeah, exactly. So that was good. I thought that. And it's not like the upstairs where you just beam over.
That's right. We have to walk. And I did. I also, I will say, I enjoyed the fact that they made him seem like he was leading them into a trap of some kind, which he was, but in a different way than you would have thought because he seems kind of suspicious.
Yeah.
With good reason.
Yeah. All right. Well, there it is. We talked for a long time about an episode that was meh. Okay.
That's nice. And I have to go to my office and water my plants.